Welcome to the Rock Show Project. I'm your host, Dave LePage. We are talking rock and roll. You're coming with me. 80s, 90s, rock of today. Buckle up. It's going to be fun. We got some top 10s coming your way. We got some interviews coming your way. Let's get started at the Rock Show. Welcome back to the Rock Show Project. Your host, Dave LePage here, trying to switch it up a little bit in episode three. I think I was talking about doing some interviews, and I was thinking to myself, what person could I interview that had a good view of the 80s from the inside and out? Was trying to get somebody musical in nature. Clearly, the first thing was alive back then. This person certainly was. And then I quickly came up with an idea. I was like, why don't I interview my brother? Jerry is an accomplished bassist in his own right and plays guitar now as well. Has had a long, long career in music. It was a passion for him for the longest time. I remember in the 80s, I tribute much of my love of music to him. Listening to him play, watching him play, hearing what he did play, a lot of the bands and music that you're hearing me come out with in the top 10s. A lot of it's mine, but for the most part, too, he left an incredible mark on my musical life and tastes as they move forward. We still, to this day, pretty much every time we get together, as you'll see coming up in the interview, we still, to this day, have no problems talking about music. What turned into one show, what I thought was going to be one show has turned into two. Jerry gave a tremendous interview with us. I wish I could give you the whole thing with all the bloopers. And you, for those of you that know us, you would have a great time listening to all of it. But I did cut it down. We had a good time that night. Jerry covers the 80s, 90s, what he's doing now. But primarily also, which I didn't see coming, Jerry will also talk about what motivated him during those periods of time and what fired him up and what music he liked and what music has made a difference in his life. So here's my first interview, the Rock Show Project, my own brother, Jerry LePage. Incredible career in terms of creating a sound in the 80s with his band Symmetry. Probably the closest thing at that point to anybody getting signed directly out of Maine. Went on a little mini tour. You'll hear more about that in the interview process. Moves through the 90s and into today. Currently in a multitude of bands, struggling to keep track with who he plays with these days. At the sake of giving up a secret, he is in Twice Shy, which is a 80s cover band that dresses up and the whole deal. Still chuckling about the tights and all that. He chuckles about it too, but I was playing bass for them for a while now, plays guitar with them. Also plays in a country band that plays some 90s stuff, some 90s rock too, a band called Blacktop Gone. It's a band I've seen many, many times. Shout out to those guys as well. Two great bands, Twice Shy, Blacktop Gone. Dabbles with a band called Goss. You're going to hear some of their music today, too, in the show. Goss is a band that was made up of three members of Symmetry and a couple of guitarists who get together every now and then and either record or go out and play live. So Jerry's busy at this point in time, but I think it's his insights on what happened in the Symmetry days and then Stone Circus and then all of the people he met, I think, was probably the coolest piece for all of this. Being my brother, people that I became friends with as well. So that was a great, interesting piece to hear in the story. Anyway, don't want to hear me. You want to hear about Jerry. So let's go. Jerry LePage, my first interview on the Rock Show Project. So I think, you know, as I was thinking about, like I told you before, I was thinking about who would be a cool interview, you seem to have a lot of input on my top 10s, although there were moments I disagreed. And you gave me what you gave me, but I really do appreciate your background in music in general. Every time that I talk about Rush, I hearken back to those days where that's all I heard. I could probably verbalize almost every bass line. It may not be on key, but I could probably get close. Oh, this is the part where it does. So I spent many years listening. I didn't have a choice in the matter.
We, for those who don't know, we were in the same room for a while, and then we were in separate rooms. Probably about the time Jerry brought, you know, kind of took up the bass, we were in different rooms at that point in time. Small house, so me sitting there with my dual cassette. This is before the Klipsch. Remember my dual cassette? I could record from one cassette to the other.
Dubbing.
Yeah, and the bass response on my 10-inch speakers with the two...
That's how we made our mixtapes in the 80s.
Like the 1-inch cone at the top, all in the finest of woods. Wasn't drowning out the rumble of bass and rush all the time. So what... and I honestly don't know the answer to this question, but what started you, particularly in music, A, and B, why the bass?
Honestly, it's not Rush. I didn't know who Rush was.
I am shocked right now.
Well, I didn't know who Rush was when I first started. My first influence for bass, quite honestly, is Gene Simmons from Kiss.
Okay.
Can I lump us in together on this one?
Certainly, because I know where you're going with
it. When we got our first stereo from our father at...
Wasn't a stereo.
Well, it was a turntable, and it was an 8-track player.
Well, no, I don't remember the turntable. The 8-track was the one you put into the deck, and then you had to push the deck down.
No, that's Mom's.
Okay.
Okay, that was prior to our
Mom
first stereo.
Mom is an audiophile.
Our first stereo, speaking of 8-tracks, anyways, so our first stereo together that Dad bought us had a record player on top. And it had an 8-track, just a slot where you put the 8-track in.
Oh, okay. And it stuck out a little bit.
Yeah. So he did not know what to get us. I remember this like it was, I don't want to say yesterday. Well, okay. Like this morning, because I don't know what I don't remember yesterday. So,
yesterday was long.
You know how long ago that was? It's like 12, no, 7. Okay. So we got that, and he didn't know what to get us. Maybe you were a little too young to remember him telling me this.
Do you remember this?
Okay. He said, I didn't know what to get you, so I looked on the face of this cassette, this 8-track, and it was a guy had blood on his face, figured, they probably like that. So he picked up Kiss Alive 2. Uh-huh. And that was the first time I'd ever heard.
How old were you? Do you remember?
Oh, my gosh.
I know it was just yesterday, but... I'm going to say, I don't even think you're in high school yet. I think we're like...
No, I almost like, want to say we were
a freshman
like,
or something.
I almost want to say we were, I was like middle school maybe even. Yeah. I don't remember exactly when that was.
Okay, so you're listening to
Kiss Alive 2, and I'm listening to Gene Simmons play, and I'm like, what is that? What instrument is that?
The guy whose blood was on his face.
Yeah, I wasn't so worried. Well, we couldn't see it then. They didn't have videos then, so we weren't like, we didn't have YouTube, right? So... We didn't have any way to see this unless we went at somebody else's house and they had a movie I don't know how we would have seen it back then, honestly. So it wasn't so much the visual, it was the audio. So that's all we were left with, right? Today we get visually distracted by stuff.
Almost sometimes before audio.
Absolutely. Right. You know, we don't even listen to the song. We're too busy watching the video. So we don't really
like
listen to what's
Post Malone, I know what he looks like. I don't think I've ever listened to any of his songs.
Right.
But I know exactly who Post Malone is based upon... His visual.
His visual. So I think today we're missing out on some audio pieces and some really good stuff that's going on because we're too busy watching it versus just listening to it like we used to do. Yep. With headphones, our little Walkmans, our little cassette players that we used to just lay in bed and listen to with just horrible headphones. But but honestly, that's where our past is, right? And then MTV came out and just wrecked everything. Now we're sitting out front of the idiot box more than we ever were. At least with music, we were in the car. We could listen to it while we were driving all over the place, which honestly is where I did most of my listening, which was, you know, in a car.
So you had an 8-track in your car?
I had an 8-track radio in my car, but then when cassettes, and I'll let you do a side edit on what cassettes are.
There's no.
Do you remember the adapter?
This is an 80s show. If you don't know what we're talking about, then don't listen.
Right, that's true too. Yeah, if you go, mommy, what are cassettes?
I almost wanted to do an 8-track side conversation, but I'm like, you know what?
Top 10 8-track. You know, or if you can remember which songs of the 8-track used to fade out, and then you hear the click, and then it would fade back in because it was the next track, but the same song. I love those parts. I never knew what some of those middle parts were until I heard it. I'm like, that's what they do there. So
you're listening to Gene Simmons.
So I'm listening to Gene Simmons, and I'm like, wow, this is really cool stuff. I mean, listen to the riff, the intro riff to 100,000 Years. You know what I mean? That's like...
I would tell you, Gene Simmons, honestly, one of those guys, very underrated bassist.
Absolutely. Yeah. And honestly, everybody's like, oh, that's not him. You ever see him play live? He doesn't play half that crap. And I'm like, I don't care if it was a studio musician. It was on a Kiss record. And I believe that Gene Simmons was the guy who did it. Maybe he was, maybe he wasn't. And he wrote some really interesting parts, some really cool parts, or played them, even if he didn't write them.
Yeah.
It was irrelevant to me at that point. I was just like, I want to do that. Yeah. I want to play that instrument because that sounds really freaking cool. Sister had an acoustic. Diane had an acoustic.
She did.
And, yeah, she did. Now, what do you think I was jamming on the couch with? Growing after that, learning that, growing up, and then Diane wasn't playing her acoustic, so I grabbed it, and I would sit on the couch. So,
this acoustic that I do not remember,
yeah.
She wasn't playing.
No, she wasn't playing. We had a guitar because I used to sit on the couch and learn the theme songs to Gilligan's Island, Batman, all the shows that I used to watch as a kid. I would just sit and noodle and Mom recognized that, and she said, hey, would you like to take lessons? And I'm like, yeah. She goes, do you want guitar lessons? I'm like, no, I want to take bass lessons.
That's going to be hard to find. And
well, Tom Ford.
Oh.
Remember Tom Ford? He used to
I know,
be
it kind of sounds like we haven't lived together, but I was young.
Yeah.
I don't
remember. You were into hockey, right? So yeah. None of that really clicks with you because you were into sports then.
No, I just don't remember all of this happening.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So she said, well, let's go take lessons with Tom Ford. So I go to Tom Ford, first lesson. Mary Had a Little Lamb.
Of course.
And I bring this acoustic. He goes, I thought you wanted to play bass. I said, I do. He said, do you have one? I'm like, nope.
This isn't one?
No. Yeah. If I take two strings off, does that work? No? How about if I draw? Oh, yeah, that sounds like poop. So anyways, he says, okay, come in next week. We'll do another lesson. I'll have a bass for you. And I said, great. So we're playing, and I'm playing along. And he's like, okay, so do you want the bass? I'm like, yeah, I want the bass. He goes, I said, how much? He goes, $60. And I'm like, and all I had is a paper route at that time. So I'm like,
$60 back then was,
that's a lot of money, right? That's like, you know, that's almost a month's wages for us, maybe, if not.
At $3 a week.
Yeah. If not more than a month's wages, right? So I go talk to Mom, and this was my first foray into finances, musical finances. Yeah.
Things have changed.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. $60 for my first bass. And I'll tell you what, I played that thing for a long time.
What kind was it? Do you remember?
Oh, it's just generic. I mean, I don't even remember what it was. It was a Fender knockoff.
But did you get an amp as well?
No, I did not get an amp at that point. It was just
But it was an electric bass.
It was an electric bass.
So yeah, you played for a long time just with an electric bass.
Just with an electric bass. Just hearing just playing, which honestly, I play more that way now than I ever have. I don't have an amp anymore. So it's funny, I went from no amp in the beginning to no amp now.
A little different now, though.
Yeah, it's a little bit different now. But honestly, I play by string just by listening to what I'm doing more, just sitting on the end of my couch while I'm waiting for something, you know, either Dorothy to get ready or whatever. Yeah. Just got 5 minutes to kill waiting in the wintertime, waiting for the car to warm up. I'll go sit on the couch and just play. I won't plug in. I won't put headphones on. I don't go into my computer, and I don't do all of that stuff. Right. I just play sitting on the couch and get my fingers moving. So that really is how I started playing bass.
Just sit right back and you'll hear a tale of a fateful trip that started from this tropic port aboard this tiny ship. The mate was a mighty sailing man, skipper brave and sure. 5 passengers set sail that day for a three-hour tour.
Because a friend of ours in the neighborhood played Tom Sawyer for me.
Who is that?
Mike LaLiberty. He said, hey, you ever hear Rush? And I'm like, No. Who? What? And he said, come in, I'll play it for you.
So okay, so that was 1981.
It had to be past 81.
Yeah, because it had been out.
Because it had been out, right. I think it came out in 80. Moving Pictures came out in 80, I believe. Yeah. 80 or 81. Yeah. And he played Tom Sawyer for me, and I'm like, oh, it's over. It is over. I'm like, that's a bass? And he's like, I think so. So then it was done. I went and picked up. I'm pretty sure I picked up Moving Pictures that week. And, okay, so let's talk about Moving Pictures for a second. That album changed my life as far as music goes. Tom Sawyer, Red Barchetta, YYZ.
Huge album.
Limelight.
Oh, yeah.
Camera Eye was mind-blowing to me because it was longer than 3 minutes.
And that was before you got into their previous albums, where they
right, yeah. Moving Pictures was my first Rush album. Yeah,
that whole sides of albums were one song.
Oh yeah, like even before that, like if you go back to 2112, yeah. You're talking Cygnus, and the whole side was a song, right? So that's what started my world.
So you moved from Gene Simmons to Geddy Lee at the point.
Pretty much, yeah. Once I heard Geddy Lee, it was all done. You have time for this story? Because this is actually a good one.
Go ahead.
Okay. And this story is, and I was thinking about this on the way over here, as a good story to tell people, not to tout, not to be braggadocious or anything, but if you want something bad enough, if you don't, things happen in life that you can't predict, you can't do anything about. What you do with them, and again, this is not, you know, a self-help message, it's my story,
yep.
Where I had a choice to make. So I have my $60 bass. My cousin Scott plays drums.
That's right.
And he was jamming with three guys, Tom Bureau, Louis Morrow, and Steve Akerley. Okay?
Tom went to Lewiston too, right?
Tom Bureau went to Lewiston.
And Scott went to Lewiston
at the time before he moved to Bath.
Yeah.
And so they're saying, hey, my buddies and I were jamming. We're looking for a bass player. You just got bass, whatever. And I'm like, yeah, I don't have an amp yet. He goes, well, do you think you might be able to borrow one?
Who's this?
And Scott asked me this. Okay. And I said, yeah, I think I can. And at the time, all I could afford was the bass. I couldn't afford a guitar strap. So I made a guitar strap out of a lawn chair webbing, right?
I remember that.
Which hurt like crazy in the summertime with just the T-shirt. Oh, my gosh, it cuts you up bad. But when you're wearing a jacket or you're wearing a sweater or something, it's not too bad. But when you're wearing a T-shirt, it hurts like a mother. So especially if you're moving it around and you're hot and sweaty. So anyways. Long story short of it, I borrowed an amplifier from Mr. Morin across the street, who was a guitar player. And he gave me his curly guitar cord, coiled,
yeah.
Right? So I'm like, okay, well, I can't get too far. I'll pull
you
the amp
over.
You must
have been a picture.
Well, the amp was about the size of your clips, and it was about that light. So every time I'd walk away from the amp, I'd pull it over. It would just fall on his face, and bang, and then the little reverb, because they were actually spring reverb in it. So it would be like, there's no digital back then. It was an actual
analog
spring
reverb.
Inside it. You hear clanging on the box as I pulled it over. And I'm like, oh, I'm going to break that. And he's going to be mad at me.
This was at the first jam.
This was at Scott's house. And all three guys had their amps and their PVs and all of their cool gear. And they're all sitting there. So we played Give Me Three Steps.
So was it three guitarists? Was Tom a guitarist?
Yeah, Tom Bureau was a guitarist.
So three guitarists, and a drummer.
And then I'm the bass player, and I had to tell them to tell me what to play. I didn't know any of the strings on my bass yet. I didn't know really what they were.
So everything was by ear at this point.
So it wasn't Give Me Three Steps. It was Freebird.
Of course.
So we're playing Freebird, right? And I don't know how to play it. So they're saying, well, that's a G string, so it's G, G, B flat, C. Just play that. So I'm playing bass, but I'm playing the same G string that is their low G string, right? It's the same octave. So all you're hearing out of me is, and I'm beating the snot out of this amp, right? It's a little 10-inch speaker with a bass, right? So I hit my low E, it just...
Because it was a guitar amp.
Because it was a guitar amp, and it had tremolo. That was fun. I had a field day with that one. Anyways, so I'm on my
G. No idea.
I'm on the G string and I'm beating the snot out of this thing. So it's and I'm just okay. So we played that one song, and there was like, all right, yeah. Well, they had already practiced before, and I got there late, whatever. So I'm like, hey Scott, do you mind if I leave my stuff here? And he's like, yeah, no problem. And I said, I'll come get it later because I think I had it dropped off and it was on my motorcycle or whatever. I forget how I did it. So little did I know. And Scott didn't tell me this for about a month or so. And I said, hey, you guys getting together again? Because I'm learning more and I'm getting better and stuff. And Scott's like, yeah, we haven't gotten together yet, you know.
Lying through
his teeth. Oh, my gosh. He just felt so bad for me because what they did was, after I left, they opened my bass case and took my bass out and so made fun of my guitar strap. That's all they did was they raked me over. He said, yeah, you know, Scott, I love my cousin. Yeah, it wasn't... yeah, it was
really how he talks.
And he's like, they poked fun. Yeah, it was the strap. and
not,
you know,
not how you
so,
played or not so how
gonna,
it sounded.
They're yeah. So that was it. And I said, that's it. I'm coming to get my crap and I'm going home and that's it. I'm done. But I didn't. That motivated me. You read about to say, all right, here comes a big turd burger, boys, because you're going to eat it the next time we play together, or you're going to see me playing with somebody else, and I'm just going to be that much better. And I took that year, and, well, you know.
So it was all like you didn't go back.
I did not go back one time and play with them.
No, well, you played the first time and then didn't.
I played the first time, never got my stuff, gave it back to Mr. Morin, never went back. To play with Scott and those guys, and Scott was like, I'm so sorry. And I'm like, dude, no, it's all good. Don't worry about it. A year later, Scott moves over off of Webster Street. Remember when they lived in that brick house? Rented it. We're in their basement. Tom Bureau, Louis Morrell said, hey, we want to get together. We want to do some stuff. And Scott's like, well, my cousin's a bass player. And they're like, oh, yeah, we remember him, right? So, and Scott's like, but... No, he's actually gotten better. And they're like, how much better? He's like, he's gotten better. I mean, I haven't really heard him play a ton, but I know he's been playing a lot. And in the interim from that time, I had bought my Westone bass. Remember that red bass?
Yeah.
And I bought a PV amp, a 15.
A bass.
The TNT.
The bass amp.
The Combo 300. A TNT Combo 300. And I'm literally playing Moving Pictures.
I remember it. That's all I heard for
right. Yeah. So I played Moving Pictures and whatever I could find from Rush for a year straight. I just sat in my room, and what was really helpful too was Spectrum Music. I would go into Spectrum Music when I was looking for an amp, and I would go sit and play and try them all out. I would spend hours in Spectrum, and what was cool about Spectrum
it's
at the
free
because it was free. Yeah, you can do that all day. You can practice all day long. So between my room at night and Spectrum Music during the day,
and some nice bases,
But at that time, I had already bought my Westone. I didn't bring it into. I just was trying amps. So the guys were wicked helpful to me in Spectrum. They would show. They would listen to me struggle through Tom Sawyer and be like, "Hey, let's figure out a different way to play that." So you're not working so hard. And the guy would just sit and show me stuff, and I'm like, I didn't know you could do that. You know?
You can use the other strings.
I can play that riff.
My hand can stay in the same place.
I can play that riff within 4 frets of each other? Are you kidding me?
I'd love to have seen that video, though, like you playing.
Oh, my eyes. I was just like, I wanted to kiss him, you know? I was just like, but it changed my world again.
So a music lesson within
just somebody watching me just struggle, and they said, oh, so that's how you play that. And they're like, looking at my fretboard, and they're like, wow, that's a lot of work. Let's see if we can make that easier and show me that. And it just changed my world. And that's when I decided to say, maybe I should learn my instrument a little bit better. And that's why when people start music or playing guitar or whatever, that's why I'm adamant. And I even told you this, learn that neck. Learn where every note is on that neck. It will never fail you, ever, ever, ever. And at that point, that's when I learned. And then video started coming out, right? MTV came out, and they used to play like Red Barchetta. And I literally would sit as close as I am to this microphone, to the TV, hoping I get a glimpse of where Geddy's fingers were.
Right.
For certain parts to watch.
So that's how he does it.
So I was mostly by ear, but I was struggling so hard to get all over the neck. And just watching him flip up and down in the same 4-fret range, 5-fret range, was just like mind-blowing to me. I'm like, I need to figure this out. So that, long story short, is where it started for me. And that
so
after,
you went back and put, went back
so
and
we
played.
Went back and played. And there was no better feeling. And it wasn't a screw you, na-na-na-na, boo-boo. It was like they motivated me. And I thanked them. I said, can you guys make it fun? You just experienced it.
To you with the old neighborhood band there too.
Yeah, with Ron and that made me better.
Yeah.
Sitting at home in my room got me so far.
Was that in that middle piece there?
Yeah, I'd say a little bit of it. I'd say a little bit of it too, because remember Paul Daigle was a huge Kiss fan.
Yeah.
So that got me back into Kiss.
He's a pretty good guitarist.
He was a really good guitarist, and he was such a natural. He was a rock star. He really was. He had the attitude, he had the look, he had everything. And it was great to have him as a He helped me out in different ways in music to understand it better and not be so worried about being amazing, not be so focused on amazing, but feel. And that's where feel came in and changed how I played as well. Could I have been a Billy Sheehan? Could I have been that fast? These scary guys that are just so flipping good that I look at today and I'm still blown away by. Still.
Yep.
I could have gone that route, and I see a lot of guys who went that route and they can't hold a rhythm to save their lives. They're too busy doing 30-second,
very similar,
16, 30-second notes in the
very
middle of a
similar guitarists, too, right? We talked about that before, where you got some guys who are just so focused on being fast.
Yeah, Yngwie.
I'm pretty sure Yngwie could hold his rhythm down, too. But
yeah. I mean, look at the songs he's written.
Like so many guys I've seen that are just so freaking fast, but
You don't want them.
They can't do they can't hold a 4-4 beat at that point.
No.
You know?
And drummers, and that's where he helped me see a rhythm section is important. And that's what made Kiss, because they weren't virtuosos. Not a single one of them. Not even Ace Frehley in his heyday. Could the guy write? Could they write songs? Could they market? Could they do all that? Absolutely. Were they the best players I've ever heard in my life? Absolutely not.
Yeah.
You know, I thought Gene Simmons was until I heard Geddy Lee, and then it was over, right? But they put together some freaking amazing music.
They could write songs.
Yeah, they could write songs, and they knew what parts, they knew what to do, they knew what not to do. Ace Frehley could have been Yngwie Malmsteen, and it wouldn't have mattered for Kiss. It actually might have ruined it, you know?
Yeah.
So so Paul helped me with band stuff, you know, the other side.
I just remember the garage. You know, with Ron and Dan or Ron's garage, and guys are playing Hit Me With Your Best Shot. There's a memory for you.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I remember Ron having his big keyboards, his old church keyboards in his room, and we used to play Dirty Laundry because it sounded so close. It sounded so much like it. Oh, my gosh, we must have played that intro like 55 million times.
Let's get down to it. Heaven with your best shot.
So, all right. So you met Louis at that point, leaning into Symmetry at this point. So you,
yeah, it started
you met
coming in. We did the cover band Symmetry.
Correct. But so Louis kind of introduced you to Luke and Dave Bale and Steve
and Dave
Akerley.
Bale and Steve Akerley. And Steve Akerley knew Jim.
Okay.
Because they both lived in Poland. They live right down the street. They're childhood friends.
Interesting.
But Jim went to Hebron Academy.
Right. Yep.
So when they brought Jim in.
Because who was singing before Jim came in?
We were just playing. You know what? I don't remember who
probably
sang.
Nobody.
I don't think anybody was singing at that point. Oh, we had Louisa Beth Grant came in for a little while, and we did some stuff with her, and then, yeah, it was just a bunch of guys playing
together.
So that
was that was in high school.
It was a little bit, yeah, it was about high school, a little bit
before. I remember you guys played that group that you just talked about. I remember Louisa Beth coming in and singing, but I also remember a show at St. Dom's. I'm pretty sure those guys were seniors. I was a junior. I was a year behind.
That was with Jim.
Right. And Jim came in and then played that. And then played that show. And then so eventually, but all the time, too, you and Luke had kind of clicked in terms of your
Rush, high school year, maybe sophomore year on, Luke and I would, especially in the wintertime, every Saturday, we would go down in Luke's basement where his drums are set up and a record player right next to it.
So so you hook up, and again, at that time, was it called Symmetry when you guys did that show at St. Thomas?
No, I'm trying to think of what the name of the band was.
Symmetry wasn't until you broke down to the four, right?
We might have been Symmetry then, but I think we kept the name.
I thought you were.
Yeah, that sounds about right. I'm trying to think of the video because I remember the beta tape. I don't know who has it. Somebody has it of that show at St. Dom's. Yeah.
There's a lot of betas and VHSs rolling around. So after high school, you lose two guys.
Yeah, we lost Steve and Dave Bale. They went to college.
Yeah, and so what's the discussion there in terms of none of you were really going to school at that point? Nobody's going to college, right?
Louis wanted to, but I think he had the band bug. I think he really thought that we could do something because we were that different. And in the whole time, he'd been writing a little bit.
So this was 85? Or 86?
Yes.
85, 86.
85-ish, right, after we graduate, when those guys leave. And I think we'd started the four-piece Symmetry before they even graduated. I think we'd talked about it because Steve said, hey, I'm going to school next year. And we played a little bit that summer.
Dave went to school, too.
And Dave Bale went to school, right. So that kind of fell apart as far as, like, you know, covers. And then we talked about writing and just starting to do originals. And Louis had some ideas. And then we decided to get together and
started writing songs.
Yeah, started writing.
At that point in time, clearly there's a commitment there from all four of you to make kind of see where you can go with this. You're putting together an album.
Yep.
Right, because that's what you do. You got, okay, we got to pick our best.
Back then, yeah.
10 or whatever.
10 out of songs. The hopefully 30. But at that time, it was 10 out of the best 12.
and the other two weren't totally complete
yeah,
yet.
But those weren't, we didn't know what those were yet.
We got a chorus for this one.
Yeah.
Do you have anything else?
Is that a guitar chord? What's
just
that?
Just
that's
a
an A? Okay.
That's a song.
We'll start with it. Hey, it's Canadian.
So you go ahead and so you pick the best 10 out of 12. And then how do you go about figuring out how to, because you record an album with Symmetry. How do you go about figuring out?
We reached out to Eddie Bushy from EAB Studios. And the great thing about Eddie, God bless him, is he had a vision that very few people had. He could see things that other people couldn't see, and some people called him a dreamer, called him whatever, but he was a really successful guy in my book in music, because
we knew about Eddie Bushy because we had an album.
The Café Ceci Bon Band, Oui Debat, and Louis-Philippe.
I mean, no jokes aside, I mean, they were probably the last kind of bigger outside of Lewiston.
He was known in Maine because of that and because of his recording studio. And so we got a hold of Eddie, and Eddie had just connected with Harry King, who had done Joe Perry Project. And he said, hey, I got a good friend of mine who loves the studio, and he'd love to record you guys. And
did he give Harry a sample of your
Yeah, we did some demos down in the basement, which, quite honestly, if you think about it, this was kind of cutting edge. We had a mixer down in the basement. Luke's drum section was completely boarded off with soundproofing stuff. Yeah, right, we had just that little crack when he was, the only time you could see Luke's face was when he was sitting down on the throne, because everything else was filled in with insulation. So we had that, and Louis had wired up jacks to the ceiling of his basement, headphone jacks that had volume knobs on them. So we literally had borderline in-ear, you know what I mean, recording gear down in his basement. I mean, and he was an electrician, so I mean, that was just no-brainer for him. Yeah. And these were like quad electrical boxes with jacks screwed into the plates, and it was awesome, though. But talk about a great place to do pre-production. We heard everything the way we wanted to hear it. Eddie would come down and mix us while we were practicing. So he really had an intimate relationship with our music. He really knew it really well. And the more we'd write and the more excited we got, the more excited he got. Yeah. So he was just such a force behind us when maybe there were times we were getting frustrated because we were literally practicing 3 to 4 nights a week.
Yep.
And in pre-production, we were 5 nights a week, 5 to 6. If we felt like that week just sucked, we spent 3 months in pre-production before we walked in EAB because it was so expensive for us. We're just kids. We have jobs.
So you guys bought your own time in the studio.
Well, what we did was we pre-sold cassettes. Remember, we pre-sold the album, and we pre-sold tickets or an album.
I remember a show you did down in, it was off of Main Street, it was one of the, you know.
The old theater.
Yeah, the old theater.
And we did that to raise money for the album. Yeah. We also did it to, actually at that point, the album was done.
Yeah. No, this was post-album.
Right, post-album was done for that show. Yeah, because we had, Jim's father was WCBB, was Channel 10. He had the WCBB truck next to the theater. Do you remember that?
Oh my gosh.
And he had the big cables coming out of the truck into the theater.
Right. That's right.
And that attracted, and it was a free concert, with so many people. It was standing room only in that show because of the truck itself. It was fantastic. You can't
people
write this stuff.
What's going on over here?
Yeah, man. Exactly what it was. You can't write this stuff, right? And that was actually our showcase for Freddie Lewis that night. That jam-packed house. He was up in the balcony. He was up in the balcony with a handful of people. And we did a show that night that was Symmetry's breakout night, and we got signed not too far after that with Freddie Lewis. But I mean, I get ahead of myself. But
so the album, but the album was made at this point in time. You guys raised the money for the album.
Yeah, we pre-sold cassettes at $10 a piece to people, and we said, okay, if you're willing to give us the money now,
then you'll get the album.
Then you'll get the album when it comes out. We had the artwork and all that stuff, and all of that. So, you know, thankful to all the fans at that point because they really financed our album.
Yep.
You know, so it's almost like a. What do they call that now that you do online? GoFundMe.
GoFundMe.
It's like the first GoFundMe ever. We should have patented that. They said, hey, buy this before we make it.
I've
you
had
can have
so
it.
Many great ideas that I just never stepped in, and somebody else stole them.
So many times where I'm just like, oh, I should have pursued that. So that was paid for. We did that, and that experience changed me as well as a musician. And again, before you go in the studio, And this worked for us in Divine when we went back into the studio, was know your crap. Yeah. It's expensive to learn your parts in a studio while you're paying for it. So Symmetry pre-produced for 3 to 4 months. We went to DAB. Luke set up his drums. We got the sounds. We did everything. And he may, if he ever hears this, he may correct me. But if I'm not mistaken, he did every song first take, right? Rhythm section was done day two. Done. I had to punch a riff. That's how well we knew this material and how well we knew these songs and how much we lived and breathed this stuff. And so we went in the studio in 2 days. They were planning on us being there for a week. And we were done rhythm in 1.5 days, I believe. I think we were done. I had to punch one riff. Other than that, we did it first take.
We'll be right back.
Harry really helped. He says, I'm hearing this. I'm hearing that.
Sorry,
and
that's
where a producer role really makes a huge difference. And I remember seeing documentaries on like Winger and In the Heart of the Young, how much Bo Hill made a difference in that album for them. They wrote these parts, but he was like, yeah, I'm hearing this. How about we do this? How about we do that? And it's so helpful to have that separate, and especially with the resume of Harry King, you know, Joe Perry Project and some of the other
people. Who was associated with Jake Isles? Was that Freddie that was associated with Jake Isles? Or?
Yes, Freddie was their manager and the Cars.
Yeah, the Cars, too. That's right.
So Freddie Lewis was a big Boston guy. Yep. And Harry introduced us to Freddie, or at least he dropped the tape into Freddie's lap saying, hey, I know your daughter wants to do some recording. Here's a sound of a great studio up in Lewiston, Maine. Check it out. Check the studio out.
But it was your stuff.
But it was our stuff. Yep. So that's what got us going on that path. And
So you go ahead and sign. You do the album. You go on, you know, in all essence, not a world tour, but a New England
tour.
With a band called Fox. I remember them.
These guys are awesome.
And again, very, you know, low-key, interesting, you know, tour, I guess. You're traveling all over the place.
Well-seasoned veterans.
There was some production value to what you guys were doing at that point, too, right?
Absolutely. I mean, and Freddie connected us with them for two reasons. One, for Fox's motivation was we took a set. That's a set they didn't have to play. Two, we hoofed gear. We were there, stagehands.
Were you getting paid at all?
No. Yeah. We got not a penny for it. It cost us money to travel to these places.
Correct. So Fox was making
what they were making. They didn't have to play a set, and they had flunkies to help them load gear. And at that time, there was a lot of freaking gear. They had a light show that was just amazing. It was just unreal.
You know this because you carried every.
Oh man, I know exactly what every amp weighed and how it felt. And yeah, so it was a really cool privilege for us to be able to go out and tour, literally in high school. Or just out of high school, we're touring, and I use that in quotations.
Yeah.
But again, another amazing learning experience, what it means to, don't forget, Symmetry played home crowds everywhere we went.
Yeah.
We had fans because most of our family was there, and they
were
our fans, right?
You pulled those fans in.
We were pretty huge in Lewiston. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Well, obviously, in your later life in a band, isn't it very similar to a certain extent? I mean,
it is to some degree.
I mean, you'll get those places that you'll have a crowd, and you'll be like, wow, I didn't think this crowd, you know, like you've talked about Manchester on a college night or something like that,
right?
You know, where you've got a good crowd, but it's not the norm per se.
No, Manchester happens to end up being the norm for us because
if you guys are going to go play,
we go play in OB, it's not
right.
It's not even close to that unless
you pull your own.
Unless you. And your friends come out.
My cronies.
Yeah. No, but it's great, though. It makes it worthwhile. But it's such a different atmosphere now, playing covers versus originals. So what Fox exposed us to, and that whole tour exposed us to, was not being in your hometown. And what does that feel like?
Namely,
St. Johnsbury.
Six people.
Yeah.
Right.
So you get done your first song, big rock ending, and the only person you hear clapping is your sound man. So
right,
you send them kudos.
It's original, so they
not only
they
that, it was a country bar.
They don't know what the heck they're
playing,
listening to.
Considering 80s, I consider us somewhat remotely progressive. We weren't mainstream. We didn't play just your standard 145s.
You were on WIGY.
Yes. Oh, my gosh.
Battle of the Bands. Do you remember the song that knocked you guys out of... Or no, the song that you...
We beat Paul McCartney.
Yes.
I don't remember what the song was.
Do you remember the song that beat you?
Yes.
After that?
Everybody Wang Chung Tonight by Wang Chung. There is nothing.
You're not bitter.
Okay, so let me give you this comparison.
Can you hear that song?
We're in St. Johnsbury, Vermont in a country bar, and we just get done playing one of our biggest rock songs called Concert. Right? So you're done playing. We're giving it everything. We're running around like we are Aerosmith in their heyday. We get done. Bam! Thank you, Bear. Thank you, Bear.
It's better than Mom.
Thank you, Mom. So yeah, it's exactly same thing, right? So, and even Fox wasn't out for our set. They just didn't clap. They didn't do anything for our set. It was the sound guy. He just probably felt so bad for us. And then, you know, so that's just where it's at. Yeah.
You heard it first here. Everybody weighing a chunk tonight.
Right. So you'd think that would crush you. No. You go on Battle of the Bands and everybody weighing chung tonight kicks your ass in a Battle of the Bands. And the song, are.
The song was Straighten Up, right? That was like your first.
Yeah, we were doing. Yeah.
So what happened towards? So you're touring with Fox. When was kind of the real deal happening? And you guys
we're touring with Fox to get seasoned, and then Freddie wants to start. So now we get a little seasoned to do a show for some labels. He's been shopping our tape around, our album around, to different records, which is really fun to think about. You know what I mean? Back then, unlike today, back then you shopped around the labels. You're looking for PolyGram. You're looking for Island Records. You're looking for labels to sign you to finance your album, and then you go on tour, which is like the ultimate rock star dream. So we're playing as much as we can, don't care where, driving distances,
This is your calling.
This is our plan, right? And we're going to be rock stars, and we're going to get signed in all of this stuff. So we finally get the call that we're going to do a showcase for Lumalia of Island Records down in Boston. I forget where. Nobody in this place.
Island Records. Which was not that big.
If I'm not mistaken, Island Records was U2.
Yep. No. U2 is what put Island Records on the map.
So we're like, Island Records, at least it's one, it's whatever. So he comes back to us, Lou comes back to us, because he's good friends with Freddie, comes back to us and says, I need to hear 30 more songs. And right about then, we all looked at each other and said, oh, bleep.
you didn't have 30 at that point.
No, we might have had 15, and that was including the 10 on the album. So we're like, okay, now we got to scramble. So we start writing songs, and we actually had two or three songs after that that
really
just came out that were really, 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 good, really good, but then we hit a block. And I'm like, and I think it was Under the Gun. And one of the things that when I started in the band and I started playing music, whatever, you know me, I like to have fun. And if it's not fun and I really have to work at something that I believe in my heart I was given to do, like forced to work, like it's a chore.
Yeah, it's a job. Yeah,
it's a job. You know, we got to write 15 more songs. Just like that, we did two or three, and it took us a while to do, and we're really happy with them and excited. But then after that, it was like, this isn't happening in for months. I feel like months. We just couldn't kind of. I didn't do a ton of writing at that point. I wrote bass parts, but I didn't really write songs or anything. Yeah. I really wrote one for the album, for the Symmetry album, but I wrote it on a keyboard. I didn't really write it on bass or anything or guitar. So anyways, we got that block, and then at that point, I was going through some stuff personally, too, where I was just, I didn't know where I was going. I had no direction. I had no desire. I was working construction at the time and didn't, and every winter I get laid off, and it was just like, this sucks. I want to do more. I want to be more. I want to do more. So I became disillusioned with pretty much everything at that point, and I decided I was going to be my own boss and join the Navy.
Together by chance, although I'd already seen one.
great place to leave episode one with Jerry. Our hero finds himself heading off to the Navy to make sure nobody will ever tell him what to do. Great job on that first part, Jerry. Second part's coming up. I think I'm going to take a little break next week. We're going to give you a break from Jerry. We're going to show episode two of the second half of the interview. That'll be coming up in a couple of weeks, just to kind of leave you hanging a little bit. What happens to our hero, Jerry, after he joins the Navy and the rest of his musical career? Next week, on to more rock. Going to get back to a top 10. We will just see what that has to be. For now, this is David Page signing off the Rock Show Project. Thank you. Thanks for listening, as always. And keep rocking, but stay safe.